Lore or leave her behind. Travel by train or by some other theoretically more secure means. And what if, the locksmith considers, the telegram was not sent from the director at all? Round and round the questions run. When it is his turn at the window, he buys a ticket for a single passenger on the morning train to Rennes, and then on to Paris, and walks the narrow, sunless streets back to the Rue Vaubereau. He will go do this, and then it will be over. Back to work, staff the key pound, lock things away. In a week he will ride unburdened back to Brittany and collect Marie Lore. For supper, Madame Manic serves stew and baguettes. Afterwards, he leads Marie-Laure up the rickety flights of stairs to the third-floor bath. He fills the big iron tub and turns his back as she undresses. "Use as much soap as you like," he says. "I bought extra." The train ticket remains folded in his pocket like a betrayal. She lets him wash her hair. Over and over, Marie-Laure trawls her fingers through the suds, as though trying to gauge their weight. There has always been a sliver of panic in him, deeply buried when it comes to his daughter. A fear that he is no good as a father, that he is doing everything wrong, that he never quite understood the rules. All those Parisian mothers pushing buggies through the Jardin des Plantes, or holding up cardigans in department stores, it seemed to him that those women nodded to each other as they passed, as though each possessed some secret knowledge that he did not. How do you ever know for certain that you are doing the right thing? There is pride, too, though. Pride that he has done it alone. That his daughter is so curious, so resilient. There is the humility of being a father to someone so powerful. As if he were only a narrow conduit for another, greater thing. That's how it feels right now, he thinks. Kneeling beside her, rinsing her hair. As though his love for his daughter will outstrip the limits of his body. The walls could fall away, even the whole city, and the brightness of that feeling would not wane. The drain moans. The cluttered house crowds in close. Marie turns up her wet face.
"You're leaving, aren't you?"
He is glad, just now, that she cannot see him. "Madame told me about the telegram." "I won't be long, Marie. A week, 10 days at most."
"When?"
"Tomorrow, before you wake." She leans over her knees. Her back is long and white and split by the knobs of her vertebrae. She used to fall asleep holding his index finger in her fist. She used to sprawl with her books beneath the key-pound bench and move her hands like spiders across the pages.
"Am I to stay here?"
"With Madame and Etienne." He hands her a towel and helps her climb onto the tile and waits outside while she puts on her nightgown. Then he walks her up to the sixth floor and into their little room, though he knows she does not need to be guided. And he sits on the edge of her bed and she kneels beside the model and sets 3 fingers on the steeple of the cathedral. He finds the hairbrush, does not bother turning on the lamp.
"10 days, Papa?"
"At most." The walls creak. The window between the curtains is black. The town prepares to sleep. Somewhere out there, German U-boats glide above underwater canyons. And 30-foot squid ferry their huge eyes through the cold dark.
"Have we ever spent a night apart?"
"No." His gaze flits through the unlit room. The stone in his pocket seems almost to pulse. If he manages to sleep tonight, what will he dream?
"Can I go out while you're gone, Papa?"
"Once I get back. I promise." As tenderly as he can, he draws the brush through the damp strands of his daughter's hair. Between strokes, they can hear the sea wind rattle the window. Marie-Laure's hands whisper across the houses as she recites the names of the streets. Rue des Cordiers, Rue Jacques Cartier, Rue Vaubereau. He says, "You'll know them all in a week." Marilor's fingers roved to the outer ramparts. The sea beyond.
10 days, she says.
At most. Weakest, number 2. December sucks the light from the castle. The sun hardly clears the horizon before sinking away. Snow falls once, twice, then stays locked over the lawns. Has Werner ever seen snow this white? Snow that was not fouled immediately with ash and coal dust? The only emissaries from the outside world are the occasional songbird who lands in the lindens beyond the quadrangle, blown astray by distant storm or battle or both, and 2 callow-faced corporals who come into the refectory every week or so, always after the prayer, always just as the boys have placed the first morsel of dinner in their mouths, to pass beneath the blazonry and stop behind a cadet and whisper in his ear that his father has been killed in action. Other nights, a prefect yells, "Achtung!" and the boys stand at their benches and Bastian, the commandant, waddles in. The boys look down at their food in silence while Bastian walks the rows, trailing a single index finger across their backs. "Homesick? We mustn't trouble ourselves over our homes. In the end, we all come home to the Führer. What other home matters?" "No other," shout the boys. Every afternoon, no matter the weather, the commandant blows his whistle and the 14-year-olds trot outside and he looms over them with his coat stretched across his belly and his medals chiming and the rubber hose twirling. "There are 2 kinds of death," he says, the clouds of his breath plunging out into the cold. "You can fight like a lion, or you can go as easy as lifting a hair from a cup of milk. The nothings, the nobodies, they die easy." He sweeps his eyes along the ranks and swings his hose and widens his eyes dramatically. "How will you boys die?" One windy afternoon, he pulls Helmut Rudel out of line. Helmut is a small, uncompromising child from the south who keeps his hands balled in fists nearly all his waking hours. "And who is it, Rudel, in your opinion? Who is the weakest member of the Corps?" The commandant twirls the hose. Helmut Rudel takes no time.
"Him, sir."
Werner feels something heavy fall through him. Rudel is pointing directly at Frederick. Bastian calls Frederick forward. If fear darkens his friend's face, Werner cannot see it. Frederick looks distracted, almost philosophical. Bastian drapes his hose around his neck and trudges across the field, snow to his shins, taking his time, until he is little more than a dark lump at the far edge. Werner tries to make eye contact with Frederick, but his eyes are a mile away. The commandant raises his right arm and yells, 10, and then the wind frays the word across the long expanse. Frederick blinks several times, as he often does when addressed in class, waiting for his internal life to catch up with his external one. 9.
"Run," hisses Werner.
Frederick is a decent runner, faster than Werner, but the commandant seems to count quickly this afternoon, and Frederick's head start has been abbreviated, and the snow hampers him, and he cannot be over 20 yards away when Bastian raises his left arm. The boys explode into movement. Werner runs with the others, trying to stay in the back of the pack, their rifles beating in syncopation against their backs. Already the faster of the boys seem to be running faster than usual, as though tired of being outrun. Frederick runs hard, but the fastest boys are greyhounds, harvested from all over the nation for their speed and eagerness to obey, and they seem to Werner to be running more fervently, more conclusively than they have before. They are impatient to find out what will happen if someone is caught. Frederick is 15 strides from Bastian when they haul him down. The group coalesces around the front runners as Frederick and his pursuers get to their feet, all of them pasted with snow. Bastian strides up, The cadets encircle their instructor, chests heaving, many with their hands on their knees. The breath of the boys pulses out before them in a collective fleeting cloud that is stripped away quickly by the wind. Frederick stands in the middle, panting and blinking his long eyelashes.
"Usually does not take so long," says Bastion, mildly, almost as if to himself. "For the first to be caught."
Frederick squints at the sky.
Bastion says, "Cadet, are you the weakest?"
"I don't know, sir."
"You don't know."
A pause. Into Bastion's face flows an undercurrent of antagonism.
"Look at me when you speak."
"Some people are weak in some ways, sir. Others in other ways."
The commandant's lips thin and his eyes narrow, and an expression of slow and intense malice rises in his face. As though a cloud has drifted away, and for a moment, Bastion's true, deformed character has come glaring through. He pulls the hose from around his neck and hands it to Rudel. Rudel blinks up at his bulk.
"Go on, then," prods Bastion.
In some other context, he might be encouraging a reluctant boy to step into cold water.
"Do him some good."
Rudel looks down at the hose. Black, 3 feet long, stiff in the cold. What might be several seconds pass, though they feel to Werner like hours, and the wind tears through the frosted grass, sending zephyrs and wisps of snow sirening off across the white, and a sudden nostalgia for Zollverein rolls through him in a wave. Boyhood afternoons wandering the soot-stained warrens, towing his little sister in a wagon. Muck in the alleys, the hoarse shouts of work crews. The boys in their dormitory sleeping head to toe, while their coats and trousers hang from hooks along the walls. Frau Elena's midnight passage among the beds like an angel, murmuring, "I know it's cold, but I'm right beside you, see?"
"Jutta,
close your eyes." Rudel steps forward and swings the hose and smacks Frederick with it across the shoulder. Frederick takes a step backward. The wind slashes across the field. Bastion says, "Again." Everything becomes soaked in a hideous and wondrous slowness. Rudel rears back and strikes. This time he catches Frederick on the jaw. Werner forces his mind to keep sending up images of home. The laundry. Frau Elena's overworked pink fingers. Dogs in the alleys. Steam blowing from stacks. Every part of him wants to scream. Is this not wrong? But here it is right. It takes such a long time. Frederick withstands a third blow.
"Again," commands Bastion.
On the fourth, Frederick throws up his arms and the hose smacks against his forearms and he stumbles. Rudel swings again, and Bastion says,
"In your shining example, Christ led the way ever and always."
And the whole afternoon turns sideways, torn open. Werner watches the scene recede as though observing it from the far end of a tunnel, a small white field, a group of boys, bare trees, a toy castle. None of it any more real than Frau Elena's stories about her Alsatian childhood, or Jutta's drawings of Paris. 6 more times he hears Rudel swing, and the hose whistle, and the strangely dead smack of the rubber striking Frederick's hands, shoulders, and face. Frederick can walk for hours in the woods, can identify warblers 50 yards away simply by hearing their song. Frederick hardly ever thinks of himself. Frederick is stronger than he is in every imaginable way. Werner opens his mouth, but closes it again. He drowns. He shuts his eyes, his mind. At some point, the beating stops. Frederick is face down in the snow.
"Sir," says Rudel, panting.
Bastion takes back the length of hose from Rudel, and drapes it around his neck and reaches underneath his belly to hitch up his belt. Werner kneels beside Frederick and turns him on his side. Blood is running from his nose or eye or ear, maybe all three. One of his eyes is already swollen shut. The other remains open. His attention, Werner realizes, is on the sky, tracing something up there. Werner risks a glance upward. A single hawk riding the wind. Bastian says, "Up!" Werner stands. Frederick does not move. Bastian says, "Up." More quietly this time, and Frederick gets to a knee. He stands, wobbling. His cheek is gashed and leaks tendrils of blood. Splotches of moisture show on his back from where the snow has melted into his shirt. Werner gives Frederick his arm. "Cadet, are you the weakest?" Frederick does not look at the commandant.
"No, sir."
Hawk still gyring up there. The portly commandant chews on a thought for a moment. Then his clear voice rings out, flying above the company, urging them into a run. 57 cadets cross the grounds and jog up the snowy path into the forest. Frederick runs in his place beside Werner, his left eye swelling, twin networks of blood peeling back across his cheeks, his collar wet and brown. The branches seethe and clatter. All 57 boys sing in unison. "We shall march onwards, even if everything crashes down in pieces. For today the nation hears us, and tomorrow the whole world." Winter in the forests of Old Saxony. Werner does not risk another glance toward his friend. He quicksteps through the cold, an unloaded 5-round rifle over his shoulder. He is almost 15 years old. The Arrest of the Locksmith. They seize him outside of Vitray, hours from Paris. Two policemen in plain clothes bundle him off a train, while a dozen passengers stare. He is questioned in a van, and again in an ice-cold mezzanine office, decorated with poorly executed watercolors of ocean-going steamers. The first interrogators are French. An hour later, they become German. They brandish his notebook and toolcase. They hold up his key ring and count 7 different skeleton keys. What do these unlock, they want to know? And how do you employ these tiny files and saws? What about this notebook full of architectural measurements? "A model for my daughter. Keys for the museum where I work. Please." They frog march him to a cell. The door's locks and hinges are so big and antiquarian, they must be Louis XIV. Maybe Napoleon. Any hour now, the director or his people will show up and explain everything. Certainly this will happen. In the morning, the Germans run him through a second, more laconic spell of questioning, while a typist clatters away in the corner. They seem to be accusing him of plotting to destroy the Chateau de Saint-Malo, though why they might believe this is not clear. Their French is barely adequate, and they seem more interested in their questions than his answers. They deny access to papers, to linens, to a telephone. They have photographs of him. He yearns for cigarettes. He lies face up on the floor and imagines himself kissing Marie-Laure once on each eye while she sleeps. 2 days after his arrest, he is driven to a holding pen a few miles outside Strasbourg. Through the fence slats, he watches a column of uniformed schoolgirls walk double file in the winter sunshine. Guards bring prepackaged sandwiches, hard cheese, sufficient water. In the pen, maybe 30 others sleep on straw laid atop frozen mud. Mostly French, but some Belgians, 4 Flemings, 2 Walloons. All have been accused of crimes they speak of only with reticence, anxious about what traps might lurk within any question he puts to them. At night they trade rumors and whispers. "We will only be in Germany for a few months," someone says. and the word goes twisting down the line. Merely to help with spring planting while their men are at war. Then they'll send us home. Each man thinks this is impossible, and then... it might be true. Just a few months, then home. No officially appointed lawyer. No military tribunal. Marilor's father spends 3 days shivering in the holding pen. No rescue arrives from the museum. No limousine from the director grinds up the lane. They will not let him write letters. When he demands to use a telephone, the guards don't bother to laugh. Do you know the last time we used a telephone? Every hour is a prayer for Marilor. Every breath. On the fourth day, all the prisoners are piled onto a cattle truck and driven east.
We are close to Germany, the men whisper.
They can glimpse it on the far side of the river. Low clumps of naked trees bracketed by snow-dusted fields. Black rows of vineyards. 4 disconnected strands of gray smoke melt into a white sky. The locksmith squints.
Germany. It looks no different from this side of the river.
It may as well be the edge of a cliff. Chapter 4. 8 August 1944. The Fort of La Cité. Sergeant Major von Rumpel climbs a ladder in the dark. He can feel the lymph nodes on either side of his neck compressing his esophagus and trachea. His weight like a rag on the rungs. The 2 gunners inside the periscope turret watch from beneath the rims of their helmets. Not offering help, not saluting. The turret is crowned with a steel dome and is used primarily to range larger guns positioned far below. It offers views of the sea to the west, the cliffs below, all strung with entangling wire. And directly across the water, a half mile away, the burning city of Saint-Malo. Artillery has stopped for the moment, and the pre-dawn fires inside the walls have taken on a steady middle life, an adulthood. The western edge of the city has become a holocaust of crimson and carmine, from which rise multiple towers of smoke. The largest has curdled into a pillar, like the cloud of tephra, and ash and steam that billow atop an erupting volcano. From afar, the smoke appears strangely solid, as though carved from luminous wood. All along its perimeter, sparks rise and ash falls, and administrative documents flutter. Utility plans, purchase orders, tax records. With binoculars, von Rumpel watches what might be bats go flaming and careening out over the ramparts. A geyser of sparks erupts deep within a house. An electrical transformer, or hoarded fuel, or maybe a delayed-action bomb. And it looks to him as if lightning lashes the town from within. One of the gunners makes unimaginative comments about the smoke. A dead horse he can see at the base of the walls. The intensity of certain quadrants of fire. As though they are noblemen in grandstands viewing fortress warfare in the years of the Crusaders. Von Rumpel tugs his collar against the bulges in his throat, tries to swallow. The moon sets and the eastern sky lightens, the hem of night pulling away, taking stars with it one by one until only 2 are left. Vega, maybe. Or Venus. He never learned. Church spire's gone, says the second gunner. A day ago, above the zigzag rooftops, the cathedral spire pointed straight up, higher than everything else. Not this morning. Soon the sun is above the horizon, and the orange of flames give way to the black of smoke, rising along the western walls and blowing like a cowl across the citadel. Finally, for a few seconds, the smoke parts long enough for von Rumpel to peer into the serrated maze of the city and pick out what he's looking for. The upper section of a tall house with a broad chimney. 2 windows visible, the glass out. 1 shutter hanging there, 3 in place. Number 4, Rue Vauborel. Still intact. Seconds pass, smoke veils it again. A single airplane tracks across the deepening blue, incredibly high. Von Rumpel retreats down the long ladder into the tunnels of the fort below, trying not to limp, not to think of the bulges in his groin. In the underground commissary, men sit against the walls spooning oatmeal from their upturned helmets. The electric light casts them in alternating pools of glare and shadow. Von Rumpel sits on an ammunition box and eats cheese from a tube. The colonel in charge of defending St. Malo has made speeches to these men, speeches about valor, about how any hour the Hermann Göring division will break the American lines at Evranches, how reinforcements will pour in from Italy and possibly Belgium, tanks and Stukas, truckloads of 50-millimeter mortars, how the people of Berlin believe in them like a nun believes in God, how no one will abandon his post, and if he does, he'll be executed as a deserter. But Von Rumpel is thinking now about the vine inside of him, a black vine that has grown branches through his legs and arms, gnawing his abdomen from the inside. Here in this peninsular fortress just outside St. Malo, cut off from the retreating lines, it seems only a matter of time until Canadians and Brits and the bright American eyes of the 83rd Division will be swarming the city, scouring the homes for marauding Huns, doing whatever it is they do when they take prisoners. Only a matter of time until the black vine chokes off his heart. "What?" says a soldier beside him. Von Rumpel sniffs. "I do not think I said anything." The soldier squints back into the oatmeal in his helmet. Von Rumpel squeezes out the last of the vile, salty cheese and drops the empty tube between his feet. The house is still there. His army still holds the city. For a few hours the fires will burn, and then the Germans will swarm like ants back to their positions and fight for another day. He will wait, wait, and wait, and wait, and when the smoke clears, he will go in. Etalier de réparation. Bernd, the engineer, squirms in pain, grinding his face into the back of the golden armchair. Something is wrong with his leg, and something worse with his chest. The radio is hopeless. The power cable has been severed and the lead to the above-ground antenna is lost, and Werner would not be surprised if the selector panel is broken. In the weakening amber of Folkheimer's field light, he stares at one crushed plug after another. The bombings seem to have destroyed the hearing in his left ear. His right, as far as he can tell, is gradually coming back. Beyond the ringing, he begins to hear ticking of fires as they cool, groaning of the hotel above, strange miscellaneous drippings. And Folkheimer, as he hacks intermittently, insanely, at the rubble blocking the stairwell. Folkheimer's technique, apparently, is this. He crouches beneath the buckled ceiling, panting, holding a piece of twisted pipe in one hand. He switches on his flashlight and scans the packed stairwell for anything he might drag out of it, memorizing positions. Then he switches off the light to preserve its battery and goes at his task in the darkness. When the light comes back on, the mess of the stairwell looks the same. An impacted welter of metal and brickwork and timber so thick it's hard to believe 20 men could get through. "Please," Folkheimer says. Whether he knows he's saying it aloud or not, Werner cannot say. But Werner hears it in his right ear like a distant prayer. "Please, please." As though everything in the war to this point was tolerable to 21-year-old Frank Folkheimer. But not this final injustice. The fires above ought to have sucked the last oxygen out of this hole by now. They all should have asphyxiated. Debts paid, accounts settled. And yet they breathe. The three splintered beams in the ceiling hold up God knows what load. 10 tons of carbonized hotel, and the corpses of 8 anti-aircraft men, and untold unexploded ordnance. Maybe Werner, for his 10,000 small betrayals, and Bernd for his innumerable crimes, and Volkheimer for being the instrument, the executor of the orders, the blade of the Reich. Maybe the three of them have some greater price to pay, some final sentence to be handed down. First, a corsair cellar built to safeguard gold, weapons, an eccentric's beekeeping equipment. Then a wine cellar. Then a handyman's nook. Atelier de réparation, thinks Werner. A chamber in which to make reparations. As appropriate a place as any. Certainly there would be people in the world who believe these three have reparations to make. Two cans. When Marie-Laure wakes, the little model house is pinned beneath her chest. She is sweating through her great-uncle's coat. Is it dawn? She climbs the ladder and presses her ear to the trap door. No more sirens. Maybe the house is burned to the ground while she slept. Or else she slept through the last hours of the war and the city has been liberated. There could be people in the streets. Volunteers, gendarmes, fire brigades, even Americans. She should go up through the trap door and walk out the front door onto the Rue Vaubereau. But what if Germany has held the city? What if Germans are right now marching from house to house, shooting whomever they please? She will wait. At any moment, Etienne could be making his way toward her, fighting with his last breath to reach her. Or he is crouched somewhere, cradling his head, seeing demons. Or he is dead. She tells herself to save the bread, but she is famished and the loaf is getting stale, and before she knows it, she has finished it. If only she had brought her novel down with her. Marie-Laure roves the cellar in her stocking feet. Here's a rolled rug, its hollow filled with what smells like wood shavings. Mice. Here's a crate that contains old papers. Antique lamp. Madame Manick's canning supplies. And here, at the back of the shelf near the ceiling, two small miracles. Full cans. Hardly any food remains in the entire kitchen. Only cornmeal and a sheaf of lavender and two or three bottles of skunked Beaujolais. But down here in the cellar, two heavy cans. Peas? Beans? Corn kernels, maybe? Not oil, she prays. Aren't oil cans smaller? When she shakes them, they offer no clues. Marie-Laure tries to calculate the chances that one might contain Madame Manick's peaches, the white peaches from Languedoc that she'd buy by the crate and peel and quarter and boil with sugar. The whole kitchen would fill with their smell and color, Marie-Laure's fingers sticky with them, a kind of rapture. Two cans Etienne missed. But to raise one's hopes is to risk their falling further. Peas, or beans, these would be more than welcome. She deposits one can in each pocket of her uncle's coat, and checks again for the little house in the pocket of her dress, and sits on a trunk and clasps her cane in both hands and tries not to think about her bladder. Once, when she was 8 or 9, her father took her to the Pantheon in Paris to describe Foucault's pendulum. Its bob, he said, was a golden sphere shaped like a child's top. It swung from a wire that was 67 meters long. Because its trajectory changed over time, he explained, it proved beyond all doubt that the Earth rotated. But what Marie-Laure remembered, standing at the rail as it whistled past, was her father saying that Foucault's pendulum would not stop. It would keep swinging, she understood, after she and her father left the Pantheon, after she had fallen asleep that night, after she had forgotten about it and lived her entire life and died. Now it is as if she can hear the pendulum in the air in front of her, that golden bob as wide across as a barrel, swinging on and on, never stopping, grooving and regrooving its inhuman truth into the floor. Number 4, Rue Vaubereau. Ashes, ashes. Snow in August. The shelling resumed sporadically after breakfast, and now, around 6 p.m., it has ceased. A machine gun fires somewhere, a sound like a chain of beads passing through fingers. Sergeant Major von Rumpel carries a canteen, a half-dozen ampules of morphine, and his field pistol. Over the seawall, over the causeway toward the huge, smoldering bulwark of Saint-Malo. Out in the harbor, the jetty has been shattered in multiple places. A half-submerged fishing boat drifts stern up. Inside the old city, mountains of stone blocks, sacks, shutters, branches, iron grillwork, and chimney pots fill the Rue de Dinan. Smashed flower boxes and charred window frames and shattered glass. Some buildings still smoke. And though von Rumpel keeps a damp handkerchief pressed over his mouth and nose, he has to stop several times to gather his breath. Here is a dead horse starting to bloat. Here a chair upholstered in striped green velvet. Here the torn shreds of a canopy proclaim a brasserie. Curtains swing idly from broken windows in the strange, flickering light. They unnerve him. Swallows fly to and fro, looking for lost nests. And someone very far away might be screaming. Or it might be the wind. The blasts have stripped many shop signs off their brackets, and the gibbets hang forsaken. A schnauzer trots after him, whining. No one shouts down from a window to warn him away from the mines. Indeed, in four blocks he sees only one soul, a woman outside what was, the day before, the movie house. Dustpan in one hand, broom nowhere to be seen. She looks up at him, dazed. Through an open door behind her, rows of seats have crumpled beneath great slabs of ceiling. Beyond them, the screen stands unblemished, not even stained by smoke. "Show's not till 8," she says in her Breton French. And he nods as he limps past. On the Rue Vauborel, vast quantities of slate tiles have slid off roofs and detonated in the streets. Scraps of burned paper float overhead. No gulls. Even if the house had caught fire, he thinks, the diamond will still be there. He will pluck it from the ashes like a warm egg. But the tall, slender house remains nearly unscathed. 11 windows on the facade, most of the glass out. Blue window frames, old granite of grays and tans. 4 of its 6 flower boxes hang on. The mandated list of occupants cling to its front door. Monsieur Etienne Leblanc, age 63. Mademoiselle Marie-Laure Leblanc, age 16. All the dangers he is willing to endure. For the Reich. For himself. No one stops him. No shells come whistling in. Sometimes the eye of the hurricane is the safest place to be. What they have. When is it day and when night? Time seems better measured by flashes. Volkheimer's field light flicks off, flicks on. Werner watches Volkheimer's ash-dusted face in the reflected glow, his ministrations as he leans over Bernd. "Drink," says Volkheimer's mouth as he holds his canteen to Bernd's lips, and shadows lunge across the broken ceiling like a circle of wraiths preparing to feast. Bernd twists his face away, panic in his eyes, and tries to examine his leg. The flashlight switches off and the darkness rushes back. In Werner's duffel he has his childhood notebook, his blanket and dry socks, 3 rations. This is all the food they have. Volkheimer has none. Bernd has none. They have only 2 canteens of water, each half empty. Volkheimer has also discovered a bucket of paintbrushes in a corner with some watery sludge in the bottom, but how desperate will they have to become to drink that? 2 stick grenades, model 24s, 1 in each of the side pockets of Volkheimer's coat, hollow wood handles on the bottom, high explosive charges in a steel can on top, handheld bombs the boys at Schulpforte called potato mashers. Twice already, Bernd has begged Volkheimer to try one on the impacted mess of the stairwell, to see if they can blast their way out. But to use a hand grenade down here, in such close quarters, beneath rubble presumably littered with live 88mm shells, would be suicide. Then there's the rifle. Volkheimer's bolt-action carabiner 98K, loaded with 5 rounds. Enough, thinks Werner. Plenty. They would need only 3, one for each. Sometimes in the darkness, Werner thinks the cellar may have its own faint light, perhaps emanating from the rubble, the space going a bit redder as the August day above them progresses toward dusk. After a while, he is learning, even total darkness is not quite darkness. More than once, he thinks he can see his spread fingers when he passes them in front of his eyes. Werner thinks of his childhood, the skeins of coal dust suspended in the air on winter mornings, settling on windowsills, in the children's ears, in their lungs. Except down here in this hole, the white dust is the inverse, as if he is trapped in some deep mine that is the same but also the opposite of the one that killed his father. Dark again. Volkheimer's antic ash-dusted face materializes in front of Werner, his rank insignia partially torn off one shoulder. With the beam of his field light, he shows Werner that he is holding 2 bent screwdrivers and a box of electrical fuses.
The radio, he says into Werner's good ear. Have you slept at all?
Volkheimer turns the light onto his own face. Before we run out of battery, says his mouth. Werner shakes his head. The radio is hopeless. He wants to close his eyes, forget, give up, wait for the rifle barrel to touch his temple. But Volkheimer wants to make an argument that life is worth living. The filaments of the bulb inside his field light glow yellow. Weaker already. Volkheimer's illuminated mouth is red against the blackness. We are running out of time, his lips say. The building groans. Werner sees green grass, crackling flies, sunlight. The gates of a summer estate opening wide. When death comes for Bernd, it might as well come for him also. Save a second trip.
Your sister, says Volkheimer. Think of your sister.
Tripwire. Her bladder will not hold much longer. She scales the cellar steps and holds her breath and hears nothing for 30 heartbeats. 40. Then she pushes open the trap door and climbs into the kitchen. No one shoots her. She hears no explosions. Marie-Laure crunches over the fallen kitchen shelves and crosses into Madame Manick's tiny apartment, the 2 cans swinging heavily in her great-uncle's coat. Throat stinging, nostrils stinging. The smoke slightly thinner in here. She relieves herself in the bedpan at the foot of Madame Manick's bed, pulls up her stockings, and rebuttons her great-uncle's coat. Is it afternoon? She wishes, for the 1000th time, that she could talk to her father. Would it be better to go out into the city? Especially if it is still daylight and try to find someone? A soldier would help her. Anyone would. Though even as the thought rises, she doubts it. The unsteady feeling in her legs, she knows, stems from hunger. In the tumult of the kitchen, she cannot find a can opener. But she does find a paring knife in Madame Manick's knife drawer, and the large coarse brick Madame used to prop open the fireplace grate. She will eat whatever is inside one of the 2 cans. Then she will wait a bit longer, in case her uncle comes home, in case she hears anyone pass by. The town crier, a fireman, an American serviceman with gallantry on his mind. If she hears no one by the time she is hungry again, she will go out into what is left of the street. First, she climbs to the 3rd floor to drink from the bathtub. With her lips against its surface, she takes long, inward pulls, pooling, burbling in her gut. A trick she and Etienne have learned over 100 insufficient meals.
Before you eat, drink as much water as you can and you will feel full more quickly.
At least, Papa, she says out loud.
I was smart about the water.
Then she sits on the third floor landing with her back against the telephone table. She braces one of the cans between her thighs, holds the point of the knife against its lid, and raises the brick to tap down the knife on the handle. But before she can bring the brick down, the tripwire behind her jerks and the bell rings, and someone enters the house. Chapter 5, January 1941. January recess. The commandant made a speech about virtue and family and the emblematic fire that Schulpforte boys carry everywhere they go, a bowl of pure flame to stoke the nation's hearths, Führer this and Führer that, his words crashing into Werner's ears in a familiar battery. One of the most daring boys muttering afterward, "Oh, I've got a hot bowl of something in my core." In the bunk room, Frederick leans over the rim of his bed. His face presents a map of purples and yellows.
"Why don't you come to Berlin? Father will be working, but you could meet Mother."
For 2 weeks, Frederick has limped around, bruised and slow-footed and puffy, and not once has he spoken to Werner with anything more than his own gentle brand of distracted kindness. Not once has he accused Werner of betrayal, even though Werner did nothing while Frederick was beaten, and has done nothing since. Did not hunt down Rödel or point a rifle at Bastian, or bang indignantly on Dr. Hauptmann's door demanding justice. As if Frederick understands already that both have been assigned to their specific courses, that there is no deviating now. Werner says,
"I don't have..."
"Mother will pay your fare." Frederick tilts back up and stares at the ceiling. "It's nothing." The train ride is a sleepy 6-hour epic. Every hour their rickety car shunted onto a siding to let trains full of soldiers headed for the front hurry past. Finally, Werner and Frederick disembark at a dim charcoal-colored station and climb a long flight of stairs, each step painted with the same exclamation. Berlin smokes Junos. And rise into the streets of the largest city Werner has ever seen. Berlin. The very name like two sharp bells of glory. Capital of science, seat of the Führer, nursery to Bohr, Einstein, Staudinger, Bayer. Somewhere in these streets, plastic was invented. X-rays were discovered, continental drift was identified. What marvels does science cultivate here now? Superman soldiers, Dr. Hauptmann says, and weather-making machines, and missiles that can be steered by men 1,000 miles away. The sky drops silver threads of sleet. Gray houses run in converging lines to the horizon, bunched as if to fend off cold. They pass shops stuffed with hanging meats, and a drunk with a broken mandolin on his lap, and a trio of streetwalkers huddled beneath an awning who catcall the boys in their uniforms. Frederick leads them into a 5-story townhouse one block off a pretty avenue called Nisebeckstrasse. He rings number 2, and a returning buzz echoes from inside and the door unlatches. They come into a dim foyer and stand before a pair of matched doors. Frederick presses a button and something high in the building rattles and Werner whispers,
"You have an elevator?"
Frederick smiles. The machinery clangs downward and the lift clanks into place, and Frederick pushes the wooden doors inward. Werner watches the interior of the building slide past in amazement. When they reach the 2nd floor, he says,
"Can we ride it again?"
Frederick laughs. They go down, back up, down, up, to the lobby a 4th time, and Werner is peering into the cables and weights above the car, trying to understand its mechanism, when a tiny woman enters the building and shakes out her umbrella. With her other hand, she carries a paper sack, and her eyes rapidly apprehend the boy's uniforms and the intense whiteness of Werner's hair,
and the livid bruises beneath Frederick's eyes. On the breast of her coat, a mustard-yellow star has been carefully stitched, perfectly straight, one vertex down, another up. Drops fall like seeds from the tip of her umbrella.
"Good afternoon, Frau Schwarzenberger," says Frederick.
He backs up against the wall of the elevator car and gestures for her to enter. She squeezes into the lift and Werner steps in behind her. From the top of her sack juts a sheaf of withered greens. Her collar, he can see, is separating from the rest of the coat. Threads are giving way. If she were to turn, their eyes would be a hand's width apart. Frederick presses 2, then 5. No one speaks. The old woman rubs the trembling tip of an index finger against one eyebrow. The lift clangs up one floor. Frederick snaps open the cage and Werner follows him out. He watches the old woman's gray shoes rise past his nose. Already the door to number 2 is opening, and an aproned woman with baggy arms and a downy face rushes out and embraces Frederick. She kisses him on both cheeks, then touches his bruises with her thumbs.
"It's all right, Franny. Horseplay."
The apartment is sleek and shiny, full of deep carpets that swallow noise. Big rear windows look out into the hearts of 4 leafless lindens. Sleet still falling outside.
"Mother isn't home yet," Franny says, smoothing down her apron with both palms.
Her eyes stay on Frederick.
"You sure you're all right?"
Frederick says, "Of course." And together he and Werner pad into a warm, clean-smelling bedroom, and Frederick slides open a drawer, and when he turns around, he's wearing eyeglasses with black frames. He looks at Werner shyly.
"Oh, come on. You didn't already know?"
With his glasses on, Frederick's expression seems to ease. His face makes more sense. This, Werner thinks, is who he is. A soft-skinned boy in glasses with taffy-colored hair and the finest trace of a mustache needled across his lip. Bird lover. Rich kid.
"I barely hit anything in marksmanship." "You really didn't know?"
"Maybe," says Werner. "Maybe I knew."
"How did you pass the eye exams?"
"Memorize the charts."
"Don't they have different ones?"
"I memorized all 4. Father got them ahead of time. Mother helped me study."
"What about your binoculars?"
"Their prescription cost a fortune."
They sit in a big kitchen at a butcher's block with a marble cap. The maid, named Franny, emerges with a dark loaf and a round of cheese, and she smiles at Frederick as she sets it down. They talk about Christmas and how Frederick was sorry to miss it. And the maid passes out through a swinging door and returns with 2 white plates so delicate that they ring when she sets them down. Werner's mind reels. A lift. A Jewess. A maid? Berlin. They retreat into Frederick's bedroom, which is populated with tin soldiers and model airplanes, and wooden crates full of comic books. They lie on their stomachs and page through comics, feeling the pleasure of being outside of school, glancing at each other now and then as if curious to learn whether their friendship will continue to exist in another place. Franny calls, "I'm going," and as soon as the door closes, Frederick takes Werner by the arm into the living room and climbs a ladder built along tall hardwood shelves and slides aside a large wicker basket and, from behind it, brings down a huge book. 2 volumes enfolded in golden slipcovers, each as big as a crib mattress.
"Here."
His voice glows. His eyes glow. "This is what I wanted to show you."
Inside are lush, full-color paintings of birds. 2 white falcons swoop over each other, beaks open. A blood-red flamingo holds its black-tipped beak over stagnant water. Resplendent geese stand on a headland and peer into a heavy sky. Frederick turns the pages with both hands.
"Pipery flycatcher. Buff-breasted merganser. Red-cockaded woodpecker."
many of them larger in the book than in real life. Audubon, Frederick says, was an American. Walked the swamps and woods for years, back when that whole country was just swamps and woods. He'd spend all day watching one individual bird, then he'd shoot it and prop it up with wires and sticks and paint it. Probably knew more than any birder before or since. He'd eat most of the birds after he painted them. Can you imagine? Frederick's voice trembles with ardency, gazing up. Those bright mists and your gun on your shoulder and your eyes set firmly in your head. Werner tries to see what Frederick sees. A time before photography, before binoculars. And here was someone willing to tramp out into a wilderness brimming with the unknown and bring back paintings. A book not so much full of birds as full of evanescence, of blue-winged, trumpeting mysteries. He thinks of the Frenchman's radio program, of Heinrich Hertz's Principles of Mechanics. Doesn't he recognize the thrill in Frederick's voice? He says, "My sister would love this." Father says we're not supposed to have it. Says we have to keep it hidden up there behind the basket because it's American and was printed in Scotland. It's just birds. The front door opens and footsteps clack across the foyer. Frederick hurries the volumes back inside their slipcovers. He calls, "Mother?" And a woman wearing a green ski suit with white stripes down the legs enters crying, "Freddy! Freddy!" She embraces her son and holds him back with straight arms while she runs a fingertip over a mostly healed cut along his forehead. Frederick looks off over his shoulder with a trace of panic on his face. Is he afraid that she'll see he was looking at the forbidden book? Or that she'll be angry about his bruises? She does not say anything but merely stares at her son, tangled in thoughts Werner cannot guess, then remembers herself. "Oh, and you must be Werner." The smile sweeps back onto her face. "Frederick has written lots about you. Look at that hair. Oh, we adore guests." She climbs the ladder and restores the heavy Audubon volumes to their shelf one at a time, as though putting away something irritating. The three of them sit at the vast oak table, and Werner thanks her for the train ticket, and she tells a story about a man she ran into just now, unbelievable, really, who apparently is a famous tennis player, and every now and then she reaches across and squeezes Frederick's forearm. "You would have been absolutely amazed," she says, more than once, and Werner studies his friend's face to gauge whether or not he would have been amazed. And Franny returns to set out wine and more Ruchkäse, and for an hour Werner forgets about Schulpforte, about Bastian, and the black rubber hose, about the Jewess upstairs. The things these people have. A violin on a stand in the corner, and sleek furniture made from chromium steel, and a brass telescope, and a sterling silver chess set behind the glass, and this magnificent cheese that tastes like smoke and has been stirred into butter. Wine glows sleepily in Werner's stomach, and sleep ticks down through the lindens when Frederick's mother announces that they are going out. "Tighten up your ties, won't you?" She applies powder beneath Frederick's eyes and they walk to a bistro, the kind of restaurant Werner has never dreamed of entering, and a boy in a white jacket barely older than they are brings more wine. A constant stream of diners comes to their table to shake Werner's and Frederick's hands, and ask Frederick's mother in low sycophantic voices about her husband's latest advancement. Werner notices a girl in the corner, radiant, dancing by herself, throwing her face to the ceiling, eyes closed. The food is rich, and every now and then Frederick's mother laughs, and Frederick absently touches the makeup on his face while his mother says, "Well, Freddy has all the best there at that school. All the best." And seemingly every minute some new face comes along and kisses Frederick's mother on both cheeks and whispers in her ear. When Werner overhears Frederick's mother say to a woman, "Oh, the Schwarzenberger crone will be gone by year's end, and then we'll have the top floor, du wirst schon sehen," He glances at Frederick, whose smudged eyeglasses have gone opaque in the candlelight, whose makeup looks strange and lewd now,